From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report this first weekend of spring, even though it may not look like it outside to some of you. I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. A new mystery illness hitting dairy herds in the South.
It appears that it's mostly animals that are in mid to late lactation.
An eroding ag economy, but there's one major bright spot today.
Cow-calf producers are going to be in the driver's seat for the next year and a half, 2 years.
An acreage dilemma is unfolding across the U.S. this year.
Unfortunately, the bank and access to capital and credit may have that part of that decision, too.
Michelle Rook hits the fields. Plus, signs of spring and signs of hope after the Texas wildfires' wrath left unimaginable scars for producers there.
U.S. Farm Report, presented by Pioneer. What's next happens when the testing grounds meet the proving grounds. Pioneer, what's next happens here.
Now for the news, a mystery illness right now is hitting dairy production in some southern states. Dairies in the Texas Panhandle seem to be hit the hardest, but there are also cases reported in New Mexico. And the American Association of Bovine Practitioners telling me that veterinarians in Kansas have also reported similar symptoms. The association says it's impacting about 10% of the herd, and it's not causing mortality. Instead, it's hitting older cows and causing a loss of appetite. As a result, milk production declines 10 to 20%. All right, here's what we know right now. The symptoms of the illness last 10 to 14 days, but the exact cause of the illness is not known. On your screen, here are some of the warning signs. Impacted herds have reported older cows in mid-lactation may be more likely to be severely impacted than younger cows and fresh cows or heifers. Texas officials say they are working with USDA to further monitor and evaluate reported cases. I spoke to Dr. Fred Gingrich, a cattle veterinarian who's also the executive director of the AAPB. He told me they're working to find an answer as they understand the primary impact right now is economic losses for dairy producers, since the herds lose about 20% of milk production for 2 weeks.
It appears that the disease peaks in about 3 to 4 days and lasts 10 to 14 days. Older cattle appear to be more clinically affected, more severely affected, lactation 2 in older animals. And although it's not consistent with every herd, it appears that it's mostly animals that are in mid to late lactation. So that's all pretty unusual that we have something going on in older animals and it's not fresh cows.
Now, Gingrich says if a dairy producer notices a rapid onset of cows not eating or a drop in rumen activity in your herd, it's essential to call your vet immediately. The Biden administration has announced new automobile emissions standards, and it's creating some concerns in the ag community. The new rule applies to cars, SUVs, and most pickups for model years 2027 through 2032, and it could push U.S. automakers to manufacture more electric vehicles and hybrids in order to meet the targets. Right now, the average CO2 tailpipe release is about 240 grams per mile. Under the new rule, by 2032, that number would be just 82 grams per mile. But the auto industry could meet the limits if 56% of new vehicle sales are electric by 2032, along with plug-in hybrids or other partially electric cars or more efficient gasoline-powered vehicles. The National Corn Growers Association and other groups coming out against the plan, saying it ignores the benefits of ethanol. There are a lot fewer wheat farms in the U.S. right now. In fact, USDA says the number of wheat farms in the country has declined by more than 40% in the last 20 years. This graphic from the Economic Research Service details the drop. As you can see, in 2022, there were more than 169,000 wheat farms in the country. But look at 2022, with the total number reaching just over 97,000. Along with the drop in wheat farms, there's been a drop in wheat production, which has remained below 40 million acres since 2017. Leaders with the National Association of Wheat Growers are hoping to address some of the profitability issues in the next farm bill.
They're looking at maybe doing 10%. So if we go from 550 to 555, is that really enough of an adjustment to offset the cost of production? And I would have to say no, unless we're going to do meaningful changes to PLC where we increase from 550 to 650 or 675 so that the PLC price is more reflective of the cost of production, then yes, we really need to be working towards that. But it comes back down to the lack of funding in the Farm Bill, and making those larger jumps in PLC are much more expensive. And so, yes, we support an increase, but it has to be an effective increase.
Gould says they'd also like to see changes to the crop insurance program, including improving coverage and lowering premiums in order to cover the cost of production. We have a new snapshot of what consumers think about meat. The North American Meat Institute has released its 19th annual Power of Meat. The survey shows 80% of Americans describe themselves as meat eaters, and the number of households that purchased meat last year held steady at 98%. Another key finding, the number of people seeking to decrease the amount of meat they eat has fallen by 20% since 2020. The data from Circana shows that Generation X accounts for the greatest proportion of sales at 32%, while boomers buy meat the most frequently at 53 times a year. But inflation is factoring into purchases. 73% of Americans are making one or more changes to meat buys at the grocery store to save money. Well, just when we started talking about the winter that wasn't in the upper Midwest and the northern plains, it seems winter is making a late arrival. We have a check of weather coming up next.
U.S. Farm Report weather is brought to you by H&S Manufacturing. Maximize baleage yield with less time and effort with the LW 1100 Line Wrap Bale Wrapper. You can wrap round or square bales, and the automatic operating mode allows for a one-person operation.
Meteorologist Martin Lowermore joins us now with weather. Martin, it may be spring, but winter is finally arriving in the upper Midwest and northern plains. There's a second storm system I know that's arriving later this weekend and early next week after they've seen really very little snow all winter.
Hey there, we're going to be looking at a bit of a chilly next couple of days if you're going to be in the central third, or honestly central two-thirds of the United States, especially across parts of Dakotas, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. Might be seeing some pretty chilly temperatures because we're expecting a low to make its way, moving in from Canada, swinging into the northern plains. It's going to bring us some chilly weather, including some snowfall as we head into the first part of our work week, maybe continuing and even into that midweek as well. But that's going to start making its way into parts of the eastern seaboard where they could be seeing those temperatures falling down as we head into April. Things are definitely going to be quite on the warm side out there for at least the next couple of days before that cold air pushes in. Precipitation outlook, a lot of green on the map here. As we get toward the end of March, we are expecting a good amount of water to start becoming down. Places toward the south and the southeast, you'll be seeing a lot of that rainfall. Parts of the north, man, turning into that snowfall. Haven't seen a whole lot of that for the past couple of days. Honestly, the past couple of months, haven't seen a whole lot of that snowfall. But we're going to start seeing a little bit of it as we head into the last couple of days of our March, possibly even into that Easter weekend. So keep an eye on if you're going to be heading out there in between the crops. Now, as we get into our jet stream, we're watching this pretty closely as this low continues to swing its way across. Again, like I've been talking about, we will be seeing much cooler air filtering its way in from Canada into the Dakotas, places in Montana, Wyoming, even into parts of Minnesota and Iowa to see some of that very cool air. But as this moves through, bringing in some more of that snowfall, swinging its way just to the north of the Great Lakes, especially. So watching that snowfall moving into the Dakotas, round to Minnesota, and out toward the Great Lakes. Should be missing most of the eastern seaboard with the exception of the snow we're going to be seeing next few days. That's this Thursday and Friday. So it's definitely going to be on that side. But if you're looking to the south, there's that low moving on. We have this ridge building in here, so we could get a nice little break for our next Friday as we start seeing much warmer air filtering in the southeast. That's going to make things feel a little bit better. But there's that rogue low moving in across, could provide some more of that rainfall across parts of the northern plains. So the drought outlook, only places really seeing the drought is down toward New Mexico. Got a couple patches toward Iowa. This right here could probably get relieved by a lot of that snowfall and a little bit of the rain we could be seeing over the next couple of days. But again, New Mexico, not really seeing a whole lot of that snow or rain anytime soon. So that rainfall, again, seeing most of that really helping out for those droughted areas out toward parts of the Corn Belt. Continue to see more of that rain moving across the southern plains.
Well, it may be a late arrival for winter in some areas, but the acreage debate is just heating up. Weather playing into that. We'll talk about what the market is expecting leading into the USDA big prospective plantings report next week. That's in our marketing roundtables next. Welcome back. Well, this weekend, Naomi Bloom as well as John Payne joining us for a marketing discussion. All right, we're waiting this big prospective plantings report coming out from USDA next week. A lot of acreage projections being released ahead of that. But Naomi, what kind of is priced into the market right now? What does the trade expect next week?
Well, trade is definitely expecting that we're going to see less corn acres planted than last year. The biggest takeaway is that there's going to be some ebb and flow throughout what comes on the report. But the big picture, keep in mind that even if we plant 3 million less acres of corn than last year, we're still going to be battling 2 billion bushel carryout into the next growing season. So that might keep the market just prices suppressed in the short term. For prices to rally significantly, we're going to need something to happen with Brazil weather or some kind of a summer weather issue here in the United States later on in the summer.
John, we'll hit on Brazil in just a second. But when you look here in the U.S., there is some thoughts that we'll see less corn acres than what we saw last year. But still, when you look at some of the amount of field work that's gone on in this Western Corn Belt, possibly could see more corn acres than what many had expected earlier on. Do you think that could be the case?
Yeah, I've kind of come to expect the unexpected in this report. This is one that you can get the wild card. Then everybody looks forward to the June one when actually the acreage data gets put in. So I wouldn't shock me to see the USDA surprise a little bit here and keep the acreage up. I hear what Naomi's saying. I think the anecdotal evidence would be that you'd plant beans just given the prices. But, you know, farmers here like to plant corn in the U.S. And, you know, at this point, given the early spring we've had and the amount of, I would say inputs are down, certainly year over year. But even looking at natural gas, like Ford summer contracts are down for natty. So, you know, irrigation costs should fall. I think you'll see corn acres somewhere close to where they were a year ago, at least off the jump. Now, whether we get it that way, I don't know. It certainly depends on weather over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, speaking of that, Naomi, we are watching weather. I mean, you're in the upper Midwest. You haven't had much of a winter, but now we are seeing kind of this winter late arrival that could change the picture in some areas.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you look at the drought monitor index and the dryness throughout the Midwest continues to grow. So yes, snow this weekend for Wisconsin, not overly exciting or welcome. It's a little too late in the season, but the precipitation coming out of it is welcome because we are so dry and much of the Midwest, of course, dry. Now, looking forward for what that means for the corn crop and for going forward for the corn season, the market is very aware that we're on the cusp where either weather's going to switch into potentially a slightly wetter weather pattern, or there are some meteorologists who are saying that this might be something like a 1988 drought if the dryness continues. So trade is aware of that. It's watching it, but it's back burner information for now, but definitely something to be watching for the future.
Yeah, I was in Iowa this week, and that is the biggest, commodity prices, but then how dry it is. That is the biggest concern for growers right now. All right, John, China's soybean imports from Brazil totaled 6.96 million metric ton during the first 2 months of the year. That is a 211% surge from a year ago. Just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, Brazil had a tough crop a year ago. So I think a lot of that might be reflected in the short-term data. Crush margins here in the U.S., are decent relative to where they were just a couple of weeks ago. And then you have the U.S. prices that should compete with the Brazilians through the summer. So you're starting to see that happen here. If you look out in the curve, you're seeing some convergence between the B3 prices and where the CBOT is offered. And I think at this point, you're seeing producers, you know, sell because of harvest. So we've got a harvest low kind of behind us here in the Brazil markets. And now we'll look ahead. And I know it's 9 months away, but we got to start looking at what Brazil is going to do a year from now, because that's where you start to see the CBOT be a tool for those new crop producers in Brazil to start selling for what they're going to grow a year from now.
John, real quick, before we go to break, I know you have offices down in Brazil. When you look at where USDA is currently on their projections for Brazil corn and soybeans, higher than a lot of private estimates, does it differ from where you guys currently sit?
No, we're closer to CONAB. I think at this point, the CONAB numbers are more what the trade would believe. At this point, though, you know, we might lose 20 million metric tons in Brazil, but we're going to make 25 million more in Argentina. So I'm not sure how that all shakes out, if that's apples to apples, but, you know, supply in South America should be okay, at least year over year.
All right. Well, we saw China come in and cancel more wheat buys from the U.S. We'll look at really the projections for wheat prices when we come back. Welcome back. John Payne and Naomi Bloom rejoining us. Naomi, we saw China come in, cancel more wheat buys. It seems like this is a trend here. But do you think that wheat sees pressure moving forward?
Feels like wheat has really kind of started to find some bottoming action. I feel like we've factored in the China cancellations right now, and the market is really more curious to see in the April USDA report where the global ending stocks are going to be at. We've been trending lower for smaller global carryout for months now, and that's what we're going to be watching going forward. We are growing wheat, of course, all over the world, but not enough wheat to meet demand. And the market's just really been ignoring it because it's more focused on Russia supplying cheap wheat to the world right now. So it feels, again, like a lot of that bearish mentality has been absorbed. We're trying to maybe finally find a low in that Chicago wheat market. And so far, feeling like the 550 area is going to be a good support base in general, looking for at some point to see a price recovery bounce here. Probably just shorter term quiet action ahead of the quarterly stocks report next week. But bigger picture, it really feels like we're finally bottoming in the wheat prices in the wheat pit.
Well, John, let's switch gears a little bit to cotton because recent weekly sales numbers have been kind of disappointing, partly responsible for the recent sell-off in the cotton market. You know, bulls this week were hoping for better numbers when it came to the export sales numbers. But, you know, do you see opportunity in this cotton market, or is really there a demand problem there?
Well, I think we'll see more acres in the report next week. So that might not be a good thing for the December contract. I think you look at where the old crop is. Old crop has a lot more of a Chinese factor here. And the Chinese commodity markets have actually been on the bid for the last 3 or 4 weeks now. You know, the Chinese stimulating their economy. I think you see that in the softs markets more than you see it in the CBOT right now. For whatever reason, the ICE contracts, which is where a lot of the softs are traded, I mean, we've been limit up for you know, markets like cocoa and cotton has done very well the last couple of weeks. And I think there's something there that, you know, with that emerging market exposure and the fact China wants prices to go up now, that cotton can perform a little bit better. As far as the U.S. goes, I think it's going to be difficult to grow our carryover too much in the short run, especially with higher acres, because if the price does go up, I think you'll see those farmers in Texas and Georgia probably shift a little bit, at least on the margins.
All right. As these farmers weigh their acreage decisions, look to get in the field, some sooner, others a little bit later. But Naomi, what is your advice for farmers as they head into this planting season?
Well, stay abreast of market news, first and foremost. The primary thing to be aware of is that I did a quick look at the past decade. July corn futures actually have a tendency to trade in a sideways range during the month of April, unless there's years of tight carryout, but that's not what we have right now. We've got 2 billion bushel carryout. And when you look back at the past decade, if that notion continues that the carryout is going to stay on the larger side, then that's really hard for the market to see a price rally during the month of April. Now, I don't think we're going to crash and burn. I feel like the worst is definitely behind us, but we need some really substantial news to get the market to rally. So be aware of those short-term quieter markets, especially if you're a person who's got corn in the bin that you're looking to price, because it might not have a lot of opportunity in the short term. We're going to need to see something bad happen with Brazil in order to get that market to spurt higher. I do feel like prices can work higher into the June timeframe, but again, just kind of quieter right now. So be aware of that, especially if you're deciding if you should make those cash sales now or not. Some people have the time to move the grain now. So those are some factors to be considering.
John, Naomi, thank you so much. Naomi, good luck this weekend as you bury out from the snowstorm.
Thanks, Stein.
Be thinking of you. Not jealous of you, but I am thinking of you. All right, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll have much more right here on U.S. Farm Report.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Tractor Tales. This week, we're Kansas-bound to check out a beautiful Farmall H.
Dad bought this tractor in 1940, but the story goes back a lot farther than that. He was only 6 years old when his dad passed away, and he must have had a life insurance policy because when dad turned 21 in December 39, he ordered this tractor and it didn't come in until October of 40. Dad would have gone to the war, but he had polio and one leg was a couple inches short. His uncle raised him on the farm, and working of horses with a bad leg was not a good deal. Dad didn't have horses around very much longer after he got this tractor. as kids grew up on it, first tractor we drove, big brother just telling me how he just about hit the corner post going through the gate this last week. All of our grandkids have got on it, driven it, some of the great grandkids. It pretty much represents my lineage. Dad was still driving it when he passed away in 2007, but it was pretty weak on one cylinder and every cylinder was dead. So I overhauled it myself, put a new clutch in it, redid the engine, painted it in the garage. And it's not fancy, but it's good enough for parade. And other than that, you know, because it was running, didn't take a whole lot to restore it.
Thanks, Greg. Well, there's one bright spot in the ag economy. We'll tell you what that is next.
You're watching U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition.
Well, for 10 straight months, we've been tracking the health of the ag economy through the lens of ag economists. But now the question is, are we in for a hard fall or a soft landing? That's this weekend's Farm Journal report. Grass greening up in pastures, planter prep well underway. Signs of spring are everywhere, but the reality for the farm economy is there could be more red than green this year.
I think we continue to see what's a weaker expectation as we look ahead. I don't want to overstate that weakness, but we continue to see our respondents saying a somewhat worse off situation as we look ahead.
University of Missouri's Scott Brown helps author the Ag Economist's monthly monitor, a survey of nearly 70 ag economists from across the U.S.
We plant a lot of corn and we get trend yields. I think I know the direction of corn prices, and it's even perhaps lower than where the economists have been to date.
Economists' views on the net farm income picture didn't really change much since February, hovering around $117 billion. That projection is a sharp drop from the $160 billion USDA forecasted last year and the record $202 billion in 2022.
Farm income does drop very sharply in 2024 in our projections relative to 2023, and especially relative to the 2022 peak, but we're just back down to the levels we saw in 2020.
It's not all doom and gloom. The monthly monitor continues to show one bright spot in the ag economy.
The outlier for me is cattle. I think cattle prices could get even higher. Cow-calf producers are going to be in the driver's seat for the next year and a half, 2 years.
The March monthly monitor asked economists what two factors will drive ag's economic health today and in the next 12 months. Economists say declining prices for many commodities with a mixed impact of higher cattle and hog prices, higher production costs, including inputs, interest rates, and land rents, as well as concerns about global economic growth and regulatory uncertainty.
I think so far the effects have been relatively muted, in spite of the problems that the situation has had in the Red Sea, for example. It hasn't had a huge impact so far on the cost of moving grain around the world. So yes, it's a negative, no question about it, but it hasn't been as big of a negative as some people feared it might be so far.
What can impact crop prices over the next 6 months? Well, economists say it's really all about supply.
But if we have an average crop in 2024, we'll be looking at lower prices for most of the major commodities as the most likely outcome. So that tends to push down not just farm receipts, but also net farm income this year as production costs remain relatively high overall.
But on the livestock side, the supply side for cattle is known.
We have the fewest cows since 1961. We have tighter and tighter supplies of beef and cattle. And so the supply side of things really sets up for increasing pressure towards higher prices.
David Anderson is a livestock economist with Texas A&M. He says the biggest wild card for cattle is demand.
Will consumers continue to buy at their current rate that they did last year with higher prices? Because we've got record high retail beef prices, certainly tighter supplies and the demand for those cattle from packing plants that now are having to fight for animals. That's part of boosting prices too, as well as that consumer demand. So it's demand at every step of the chain, so to speak.
So just how much higher can cattle prices go? This month's monitor jumped another $3 per hundredweight.
Even if we started herd expansion this year out of, let's say, a calf that was born this spring, she's not going to have her first calf for 2 years. And it's another 18 months before that animal is at their finished weight and becomes beef. And so that's almost 4 years if we started aggressively expanding today.
Anderson says that means it could be 2028 or even 2029 before we start rapidly expanding beef supplies, a sign that elevated cattle prices could be in for a long ride if demand can hold. As hog producers come off their biggest losses ever in 2023, economists are slightly optimistic for 2024.
You look at our forecast for corn prices. Back in December, we were suggesting a 2024-25 price of a little more than 470. We're setting below 450 in the March survey. So cheaper feed costs, I think, help on the productivity side.
Even if 2024 is a break-even year for producers, economists warn it won't be enough to help them dig out of the hole that was created last year.
No, it's not enough to recover from all of that, because those were like record large losses. You know, and that's one of the interesting things on the hog side is, you know, why don't we see a lot more cutback in production already because of those losses? And we don't really see that.
As for spring planting, the March Monthly Monitor found nearly 80% of those surveyed say soybeans pencil better than corn this year. But even with those economics, economists increased their corn acreage projections slightly from last month.
We're certainly seeing maybe an early spring that's allowed folks to get more fertilizer on, more anhydrous on than we would have thought earlier.
With higher costs and tighter margins for row crops, now the question is if the U.S. ag economy will see a hard fall or a soft landing this year.
I'm still in the soft landing side of things, but I want folks to do enough risk management to hopefully prevent the hard fall.
If things play out the way we have them currently projected, it's a relatively soft landing, and in a sense, it's not a continued crash where we see a repeat of some of the horrible times we've had sometimes in the past in farm finances. But definitely the risks are there. You know, so again, I could easily tell you stories that are much more negative than we've got here, and the opposite is also true, that we could have a better picture as well.
Now, the Food and Policy Research Institute, or FAPRI, also releasing its annual 10-year outlook for the farm economy this week. The baseline not only provides an overview of what major issues could impact ag, but it also serves as a reference point in shaping policy. Westhoff says one key finding is just how important crop insurance could be over the next decade. As he says, it could be a much larger share of the overall farm support picture than the basic commodity programs under current law today. Well, when we come back, a surge in grain exports from Ukraine. Ag Around the World is next. Now for a glimpse of Ag Around the World. It's reported farmers in Ukraine are seeing an unexpected surge in grain exports thanks to Ukrainian naval drones successfully neutralizing Russian warships in the Black Sea. The Wall Street Journal reports this military success has created a safe corridor for shipping from main ports like Odessa, and it's helping to boost grain exports close to pre-war levels. It reported grain exports more than doubled in December compared to September, but challenges do remain, including ongoing attacks on Odessa and logistical hurdles. Famine and hunger remain serious issues in Gaza. The UN says a famine is imminent in northern Gaza. That's where 70% of the remaining population is experiencing what they call catastrophic hunger, adding that war could eventually push about half of Gaza's total population to the brink of starvation. The report comes amid calls for Israel to streamline aid into Gaza's Strip, one EU diplomat calling the issue of famine entirely man-made. The UN also says as many as 5 million people in Sudan could face catastrophic food insecurity and starvation since democracy collapsed last year. Now, one of the warring factions, the Rapid Support Forces, is reportedly forcing civilians, including children, to enlist or starve. CNN says it spoke to 36 eyewitnesses, survivors, and families of victims. The RSF, they say, is weaponizing hunger by denying food to those who won't join. Aid groups say almost 4 million children in Sudan are already malnourished as the country faces mass starvation. If aid agencies can't get food to those in need, almost 250,000 children could die. It's reported the RSF control every aspect of farming this land, controlling the warehouses of food and aid, the seed supplies, fertilizer, pesticides, agricultural machinery, and irrigation channels. And witnesses say farmers are being targeted, brutalized, degraded, and even killed, not just to control food, but to force their allegiance. The RSF deny they are responsible for the hunger gripping the country. All right, that's it for a look around the globe. Well, a desperate call to stop the bleeding when it comes to labor issues in ag here in the U.S. That's Chip's Corner next.
Chip's Corner on U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by Grounded. Spray smarter and improve herbicide performance with Grounded, a multifunctional adjuvant from Helena.
Welcome back to Chip's Corner this weekend. Chip, you interview a lot of different folks every week on the show, but one of my favorite segments, I think, is actually the Farmer Forum.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the favorite things that we do each week. It's Wednesday mornings. We gather a couple of farmers. We talk about the challenges. We talk about the opportunities that they are looking at for the year ahead. And every now and then, a really unique situation comes along, like this last week on AgriTalk for the Farmer Forum. We worked with the American Farm Bureau Federation, who was doing a fly-in to Washington, D.C., of some farmers from across the country to talk about labor issues. Now, as row crop producers in the middle of the country, sometimes labor kind of falls off of the radar as far as a top issue. But for these two producers, one from Kansas, one from New York, labor and labor issues are right at the top. Laura from Kansas does a spectacular job explaining some of the issues that she faces.
Obviously, we would love a comprehensive labor reform package, but first and foremost, we must stop the bleeding. And some of the things that we're asking for is specifically a hold on that mandated wage rate. You know, that currently is increasing at percentages that are outpacing what the market can handle. You know, we also need to have rescind that disaggregated job differentiation. Blanket policies like that, where agriculture is such a diverse landscape with diverse needs, and how we, our labor is, you know, tends to their task, it's just so diverse, and blanket policies like that just don't work.
Tyne, think about what we're doing here. We're mandating wages. We are mandating housing, mandating transportation. All of those things have a cost for the producer. There's Laura, a custom harvester out in hard red winter wheat country, is dealing with mandates in a business where there are, it's a moving target. The profits, the margins are a moving target, yet your costs are fixed. There's no way to pass those additional costs, mandated costs, on over to the producers that they're running the custom harvester for. We also talked with Karen from New York, who is a vegetable and a produce farmer. Think about that situation. It's gotten to the point, Tyne, that the mandates on wages, on housing, on transportation have made it more affordable to import berries, to import cherry tomatoes, products like that, than it is to produce them in the U.S. and consume them here in the U.S. That doesn't make any sense. That's a labor requirement that's turned upside down for a lot of U.S. producers.
Well, but Chip, when you look at labor reform, immigration reform, it seems like this is getting lumped in to the broader border security issue that's making it even more difficult to get this addressed right now.
It is. It's an issue that the lawmakers want to continue to kick down the road. So even though they may be presenting some labor issue solutions to lawmakers, it gets bound in to the migrant issues, and that just means in this environment, it's going to get kicked further down the road.
Frustrating, definitely.
Yep.
All right, Chip Flory, host of AgriTalk. You can catch him live 10 a.m. Central every weekday or 2 p.m. Central for AgriTalk PM. Chip Flory, thanks so much. All right, we need to take a quick break, and then there is a planting acreage dilemma. We check in with Michelle Rook right after the break. Well, this upcoming Thursday, USDA will release its prospective plantings report, giving us really the first look at what farmers are intending to plant in 2024. However, weather and the market environment is much different than a year ago. And this weekend, Michelle Rook looks at how that might have influenced farmers' decisions.
At the Ag Outlook Forum in February, USDA projected soybeans would be up nearly 4 million acres from 2023 at the expense of nearly every other crop, but in particular corn. And private estimates are showing similar shifts, but to a lesser degree. And the farmers I talked to are saying much the same.
Many planting decisions were already made last fall as cooperative weather allowed input applications, and many farmers chose to keep normal crop rotations.
We're usually half and half, half soybeans, half corn, and we'll remain the same. And I think most people in our area will probably do the same.
That's true even in fringe areas.
Most of the guys I talk to are gonna stay with their rotation to keep things so that, you know, so they're not off balance in years to come. There might be some beans or corn that gets switched over to bean acres, but I don't think it's going to be a massive switch. I think it'll be minimal.
However, with their lower cost of production, market analysts are expecting more soybeans.
Unfortunately, the bank and access to capital and credit may have that part of that decision too. Obviously, beans are a less capital intensive crop to plant than corn. Interest rates are as high as they've been in 40 years. And so that might be part of the decision as well.
Ag Market is seeing this trend with a 2.5 million acre increase in soybeans to 86.1 million and a 3.1 million acre decrease in corn at 91.5. This narrows the acreage gap between planted acres for corn and beans compared to 2023.
11 million acres difference last year, you know, 94 and change down to 83 and change. I've got to think, given the fact that corn, you know, just look at cash prices, for instance, that comes from the USDA, down almost $1.80 year on year, whereas soybeans is about $1.60. You know, relatively speaking, obviously soybean prices have performed better than corn.
In Allendale's survey, farmers are indicating a smaller shift than USDA predicted, planting over 2.2 million more acres of soybeans, but only 1.2 million acres less corn. The corn-soybean ratio favors soybeans at over 2.5 to 1. So what's throttling back the shift?
You're looking at most cash corn break-evens, roughly 5 to 5.20 or so, and soybeans 12 to 12.20 or so per bushel. So the corn discussion is a question of how much do we want to lose at these current bids right now for new crop. As it stands right now, the survey suggested, and farmers are quite consistent with this, they suggested that we're going to stay with standard rotation for now.
The caveat is the weather, which could entice a few more acres of corn this spring, especially with ideas farmers can bushel up.
If we have an earlier spring, farmers still like to plant corn. They like to get that crop in early.
One big loser in 2024 is wheat, with less fall plantings and projections of 2 to 3.5 million less total acres due to lower prices.
I would expect, as if prices stay where they're at, we're probably going to see a small decline in our wheat acreage, but unfortunately that has been the trend over the last 10 years.
Bucking the trend is cotton. After consecutive years of losses due to drought, it may have attracted a few acres on a winter rally.
Cotton's going to take some corn and some soybean acres in the south. But I do still think we'll get the higher acreage, but not quite as much as what maybe some people think, because December has been slower to show it.
And sorghum plantings look flat, with increases in parts of the Texas offset farther north.
A lot of wheat that's out there, but as always, there's a lot of questions on what happens on some of those wheat acres, and so we'll see, but optimistic that at the least we're flat.
However, Mother Nature will dictate the final mix. I'm Michelle Rook for U.S. Farm Report.
Thanks, Michelle. Well, signs of spring and signs of hope after the largest wildfire in Texas history ravaged the panhandle. From the Farm is next. Well, next week will mark a month since the wildfires raged across the Texas panhandle. But as Texas Farm Bureau shows us, the pain from the losses is unimaginable for the Bauer family, three brothers who experienced the wildfire's wrath on their own ranch north of Pampa.
What we've lost for certain, the number of deads were just right over 200 head of cows. The calves, we found about 85 to 90 dead, because we're right in the middle of calving season. It was pretty emotional. We scattered out that first day, and we went three different directions. I think I got to the bad pasture first. Pretty emotional to see all those dead cattle out there. And a lot of them were the young 3 and 4 year old cows we had.
It's not real fun to put down some of your cows. We've all spent a lot of time together, and it's pretty tough to walk out there and see the ear brands on this cow.
Right now, our head is wrapped around getting these cows out to grass and get them off this burned country, because right now we're just pouring hay to them every day, and a lot of it.
And thank you to the people who donated that day.
It is just unbelievable. the next few weeks, we're just focused on getting these cows to places and keeping them healthy. I mean, the stress on these cows is just, it's not good, you know. But cows are more resilient than you think, and I mean, they're going to, they'll overcome it. The baby calves, it's going to be super tough on them. That's what we're pretty concerned, not only what we've lost all these baby calves, but what we'll probably lose in the next 3 or 4 months, you know, just because of the health. I mean, we're having to move these things that are less than a week old. You have to have faith. I mean, we live off faith. We'll just keep our faith strong, and God sending all these people helping out, you know. I mean, the friends and the neighbors, it's just...
The ag community supports each other in a way that...
Unexplained.
Wild, yeah.
Unexplained.
And you always see the panhandle strong, and it darn right panhandle strong, but it's everywhere.
Just heartbreaking. But to end on a brighter note, grass is growing once again after more than 1.5 million acres burned in the wildfires. Texas Farm Bureau's Gary Joyner took this picture. He says there's still a long road ahead for the pastures and fields to recover, but it's a start. And with it, hope rises from the ashes, spreading through the panhandle. Amen. Well, that does it for U.S. Farm Report this weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to join us again next weekend as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.